All right, folks, welcome back. We are moving on in our series of Jim Garrison's book, On the Trail of the Assassins, One Man's Quest to Solve the Murder of President Kennedy. In the book, we're moving on to Chapter 14, which is entitled The Company. From the beginning, I was concerned about the insufficient size of my staff and budget for an investigation of the JFK assassination. Early on, there might have been a chance of obtaining a special increase in our budget, but that had been blown to smithereens by the editorial in the local press and the national onslaught that followed. The dilemma was solved in an unexpected way. Practically out of the blue, volunteers who had heard about the investigation came to help us. Some arrived on the scene personally, some wrote, others called. By the spring of 1967, we had acquired an assistant special team made up of volunteers. The extra help turned out to be a great lift to the morale of the special team. One volunteer we picked up was a young Englishman who had been working at the National Archives in Washington. He sent us copies of his excellent research work, and inasmuch as we had no one in Washington to do archive research, in particular to obtain copies of commissioned documents for us, we added him to the staff. Later, we had to move him to New Orleans to maintain our accumulating investigative files, which we called the archives. Next, there drifted in a most impressive volunteer, a broad-shouldered, square-jawed former case officer of the CIA named William Wood. Recognizing that this was a rare opportunity to understand the workings and the mentality of the agency, we were eager to grab him. However, before we did, we wanted to make sure that he had actually been with the CIA. His story was that he had been with the agency 7 years, but had been dropped after he became an alcoholic. While he bore no ill will against the company, which is another slang term used to refer to the CIA, he felt strongly about what we were trying to do in our Kennedy investigation and wanted to be of help. He was a newsman from Austin, Texas, and had credentials supporting his considerable experience as a newspaperman and investigator. Wood saw that we were not completely satisfied about his past agency connection, so he made a suggestion. He had the impression, he said, that an old friend of his from agency days was still in charge of the agency infirmary at Langley, Virginia. He gestured to Lou Ivan, who had been sitting on our long initial interview. Why not, he suggested, have Ivan call the CIA, get the doctor on the phone, and then listen in on the conversation between Wood and the doctor. When the doctor was on the phone and Wood responded, it became obvious that they knew each other well. Wood told the doctor that his drinking days were over, and while he missed the agency, he had been doing well in the newspaper business. The doctor wished him good luck. Satisfied that Wood had a genuine agency background, we welcomed him to the team. Because of the curiosity of the news media about our activity, we decided it would be best to keep it quiet that we had a former agency man on board. From that time, we used the name Boxley instead of Wood. Bill Boxley became a familiar figure in and out of the office. He always carried a loaded .45 pistol, which he kept in a holster under his armpit. This indicated to me that his original intelligence service had been in the U.S. Army, because all the other American intelligence services used the 38 caliber revolver. He also carried with him a large rectangular black briefcase. He was an indefatigable worker, and it was apparent that he was dedicated to our effort. Additional volunteers helped handle the burgeoning leads coming in. One was an urbane, very bright young man who had grown up in Latin America and spoke Spanish like a native. He was useful in interviews with Cuban exiles. Jim Rose, another former CIA employee, was accepted after a strong recommendation from Boxley, who had known him back in his agency days. Rose had a number of photographs showing himself instructing anti-Castro guerrilla trainees at the No Name Key training camp in Florida back in the early 60s. Another volunteer was a private detective whose substantial business offered us access to technical equipment we needed. Another volunteer from the West Coast had family money which provided him with plenty of free time and a useful travel capability. With the enthusiasm in the fertile minds of the volunteers, the outlook appeared excellent for a real increase in our productivity. The only problem, as we would later learn, was that many of the volunteers with us were at the behest of the CIA. In fact, during one period, there was almost as many men in our special team working for the federal government as were for the New Orleans DA's office. As time passed, however, one would make a misstep, and I would winnow that one out. Well, let me stop here and opine for a moment. I would be very hesitant to bring on these people. You don't know where their loyalty lies, and if they're a good liar, they're going to convince you that they're neutral and they want to help you and all this kind of BS. And I would just be extremely suspicious of them. And I probably wouldn't let any of them on, right? That's my feeling about it. I feel that strongly about it. I have no doubt they tried to send people in to sabotage, disrupt, distract, misdirect, feed false info, waste time of Jim Garrison and his staff. And it doesn't sound like thus far in the book he's really saying that he was aware of this. Continuing on. At the beginning of the investigation, I had only a hunch that the federal intelligence community had somehow been involved in the assassination, but I did not know which branch or branches. As time passed and more leads turned up, however, the evidence began pointing more and more to the CIA. For example, one of the key players, Guy Bannister, had passed ties to the ONI and the FBI, but his work in New Orleans with the Cuban guerrillas had to be CIA. David Ferry, of course, had trained guerrillas for the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was a CIA operation, and Jules Enrico Kimball had flown on a strange mission to Montreal with Shaw and Ferry, admitted to getting assignments from the CIA case officers. The impersonation of Oswald in January 1961 at Bolton Ford, where trucks were being purchased for the Bay of Pigs invasion, smelled of the CIA, as did the involvement of George de Morenschild with Lee Oswald. The last-minute change in the parade route in Dallas was highly suspicious and raised serious questions about the mayor of Dallas, Earl Cable, and his brother, former deputy director of the CIA, Charles Cable, who had been fired over the Bay of Pigs fiasco. The parade route change, along with other leads pointing to the CIA, had been covered up neatly by the Warren Commission and its point man for intelligence issues, former CIA Director Alan Dulles. Everything kept coming back to Cuba and the Bay of Pigs and the CIA. But why, I kept asking myself, would the CIA, entrusted with protecting national security, want to assassinate its own president? All the evidence kept pointing to that, but it just did not make sense. To try to get some handle on it, I began reading everything I could get my hands on concerning the Cold War, the Kennedy presidency, and the intel community. With the whole house dark except for a circle of light around my desk, I would stay up until the early hours of the morning, engrossed in books. Somewhere I hoped to find a clue of what might have motivated the CIA, or parts of it, to get rid of Kennedy. As I gained more knowledge over a period of months, a possible reason for the assassination started to emerge. Beginning with his refusal to make air support available to help rescue the CIA's disastrous invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs in April of 61, President Kennedy had adopted a highly distrustful stance toward the Cold Warriors at the CIA. More important, he had taken significant steps toward a détente with the Soviet Union. Over the initial protests of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he had authorized the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, to sign a nuclear test ban treaty with the Soviet Union in 1963. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, he had rejected his advisor's recommendations to bomb and invade Castro's Cuba. Instead, using a naval blockade, he had reached a private understanding with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, which included Kennedy's commitment that the United States would abandon any plans to invade Cuba. The FBI raid in the summer of 1963, shutting down the CIA's anti-Castro guerrilla training camp north of Lake Pontchartrain, was part of the implementation of that understanding. All of this defied more than a decade of Cold War foreign policy engineered largely by John Foster Dulles, President Eisenhower's Secretary of State, and his brother, CIA Director Alan Dulles. By July of 1963, President Kennedy had directly and eloquently renounced the Cold War in a landmark speech at American University in Washington, D.C., underscoring that the United States and the Soviet Union had to live together peacefully on one small planet. But none of these policy changes was as significant, in retrospect, as Kennedy's intention to withdraw all American military from personnel. All American military personnel from Vietnam. Why this decision so horrified the foreign policy establishment could be understood only by going back to the beginnings of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. The American Cold Warrior's view since the end of World War II, I learned, was that under no circumstances could the U.S. lose control of Vietnam and its valuable natural resources. As early as 1952, a secret National Security Council memo stated this bluntly: Communist control of all of Southeast Asia would render the U.S. position in the Pacific offshore island chain precarious and would seriously jeopardize fundamental U.S. security interests in the Far East. In 1954, after French troops surrendered to Ho Chi Minh's forces at Dien Bien Phu, all the relevant powers, except the U.S., signed the Geneva Accords temporarily separating the country along the 17th parallel until unification elections could be held. To rescue the American investment, Secretary of State General Nathan Twining, Secretary of State Dulles, General Nathan Twining, and Admiral Arthur Radford initiated a plan for the American military to invade Vietnam, but President Eisenhower blocked it. Instead, Eisenhower, in effect, approved a permanent division of the country by canceling the scheduled elections and creating a separate government in South Vietnam. Under CIA control, military advisors were used to prop up a puppet dictatorship against Ho Chi Minh's forces from the north and the Viet Cong forces in the south, both which were seeking unification of the country. This was the situation John Kennedy inherited as incoming president. At first, he went along with CIA pressure and authorized an increase in the number of U.S. military advisors. However, he refused to send combat troops. At the time of his death, observed his advisor Kenneth O'Donnell, he was determined to limit American assistance to Vietnam to technicians, helicopter pilots, and Green Beret advisors, saying, "I'll never send draftees over there to fight." In 1963, in October, seeing the U.S. bogged down in a no-win situation, Kennedy instructed Defense Secretary Robert McNamara to immediately withdraw 1,000 American military advisors from Vietnam, an order that was quietly rescinded after his death, of course, and he planned to withdraw all American forces by the end of 1965. This decision, on top of the new Cuba policy and the signing of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, added up to nothing less than a fundamental break with Cold War foreign policy, which had been the lifeblood of the CIA. Here, it seemed to me, was a plausible motive for the assassination. Though my thinking at this stage was not very developed, at least I could see that the CIA's vested interest, as well as its ideological commitment, were to the continuation of the Cold War. John Kennedy had not only threatened to end that, but had also, as recalled by Senator George Smathers, threatened to strip the CIA of its exorbitant power. Along the way, he had made implacable enemies, from top-level CIA Cold Warriors like Alan Dulles, General Charles Cable, and Richard Helms, who was the then deputy director in charge of covert operations, down to anti-Castro Cuban exiles who felt betrayed at the Bay of Pigs invasion. While it was difficult for me to accept that an entire agency as enormous as the CIA could have sanctioned and carried out a plan to assassinate the president, it did not seem unreasonable that rogue elements within the agency or contract agents who had been working with them on other projects might well have. That encompassed a lot of people, among them Clay Shaw, Guy Bannister, David Ferry, and a plenitude of Cuban guerrillas who had been trained north of Lake Pontchartrain. Although none of the evidence we had gathered definitively implicated the CIA, I realized that sophisticated intelligence agencies rarely left smoking guns lying around. Amazingly, though, leads pointing to the agency continued to come in. This must have worried somebody at Langley because my staff was infiltrated, and gradually, over time, I learned that the agency was actually attempting to obstruct our investigation. This only added to my suspicions that the CIA, or some part of it, had been deeply involved in the assassination. The agency's attempted obstruction of our investigation became increasingly perceptible when we tried to extradite Gordon Novel from Ohio. This legal maneuver grew out of the clandestine visit by some of Guy Bannister's associates to the blimp base at Huma, Louisiana. They had removed munitions from the Schlumberger bunker in the middle of the night and brought them into New Orleans. Sometime after we learned about this jaunt, an informant advised us that Novel had taken a photograph of the truck used in picking up the munitions. Subsequently, Novel had sold the photograph to Walter Sheridan of NBC. I discussed this unusual case with the DA of Huma, and he insisted that as far as his jurisdiction was concerned, the removal of munitions from the Schlumberger bunker had been a burglary. In my judgment, the transport of the burglarized material into New Orleans had been a felony, and the disposal of evidence relating to the offense, the sale of the photograph to NBC, was also a crime committed in New Orleans. However, before I could question Novel about this latest adventure involving Guy Bannister and his personal war against Cuba, Novel picked up word that I was looking for him, probably one of a half dozen CIA men I had naively embraced as associates, and hit the road. We located Novel in Ohio and moved for his extradition in April of 67. We wanted to know why the ammunition had been taken from the Schlumberger bunker, why it had been brought into New Orleans, and why the photograph of the truck had been sold to Walter Sheridan. In the following weeks, Gordon Novel, through interviews and press conferences in Ohio, began providing the public with more enlightenment about some of the CIA's activities that we had been able to develop in the previous several months. Among other things, he announced that the Schlumberger bunker business had been a CIA enterprise all the way. Even though the New Orleans State's item, which had shown no great interest in our investigation, headlined an article, "Evidence Links CIA to DA Probe." The article stated that the strongest CIA ties lead to Gordon Novel. It went on to say that Novel had informed a number of acquaintances that he had been a CIA operative and would use this fact to clear himself of charges that he had participated in the burglary of the Schlumberger bunker. There's an author's note here. The notion that knowledge of one's activities by the CIA could constitute a defense in a criminal proceeding is not that far-fetched. In 1982, five Irish Americans were acquitted by a Brooklyn federal court jury of gun-running charges, which, they argued, the CIA had known about and tolerated for years. To polygraph operators and to friends and associates, the paper wrote, Novel has said the munitions burglary was no burglary at all, but a war materiel pickup made at the direction of his CIA contact. Novel indicated that the Schlumberger bunker at the blimp base was in actuality a CIA staging point for munitions destined to be used as part of the abortive Bay of Pigs attack on Castro's Cuba. Novel identified the other men present at the removal of the munitions from the bunker as all working for the CIA, among them David Ferry, Sergio Arcacha Smith, former head of the Cuban Revolutionary Front in New Orleans, who moved to Dallas following this incident, and a number of anti-Castro Cubans whom he did not know. Approximately 1 month later, new evidence indicated more strongly Novel's apparent linkage to the CIA. A few weeks after Novel had departed the New Orleans scene, two young ladies moved into his apartment in the French Quarter. While cleaning the apartment, they found a penciled draft of a letter wedged under a plastic cover alongside the kitchen sink. The note came to the attention of Hoke May, a States Item reporter, and May subsequently showed the letter to me. When he asked me for permission to publish it, I told him to go ahead. The authenticity of the letter was confirmed by Novel's attorney, Steve Plotkin, who stated, "Everything in the letter, as far as Novel is concerned, is actually the truth." Gilbert Fortier, a leading New Orleans handwriting expert, concluded after comparing the letter with other samples of Novel's handwriting that it indeed had been written by Novel. The letter was addressed to Novel's apparent New Orleans CIA contact, a man identified only as Mr. Weiss. It should be added that this letter was written in January of 67, before our investigation had surfaced. In his letter, Novel stated this, "I took the liberty of writing you direct and apprising you of the current situation, expecting you to forward this through appropriate channels. Our connection and activity of that period involves individuals presently about to be indicted as conspirators in Garrison's investigation. Garrison has subpoenaed myself and an associate to testify before his grand jury on matters which may be classified top secret." Novel's letter went on to say that the agency should take appropriate counteraction relative to Garrison's inquisition concerning us. He suggested that this could best be handled through military channels vis-a-vis DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency man. Garrison is presently colonel in Louisiana Army National Guard and has ready reserve status. Here we had Gordon Novel suggesting to the CIA that it have the military assign me to active duty as a way to get me off his back. In the end, I was not called for active duty. Nonetheless, we were unable to extradite Novel from Ohio. Even a personal call by Governor John McKethan of Louisiana to Governor James Rhodes of Ohio requesting to extradite Novel resulted only in Novel's continued protection as a fugitive. Ohio returned Novel's extradition papers to us, stating that they had contained technicalities which do not comply with the law. This was the first time our office had ever failed in an extradition case, but unfortunately, as we continued to investigate the JFK assassination, it would not be the last. Most of the extraditions I sought in this case were blocked as if a giant foot had stepped on my office. These included an attempt to extradite from Nebraska Perry Russo's ex-girlfriend, Sandra Moffat, who had been at the party at David Ferry's about which Russo had testified. We received even less cooperation from the federal government than from the states. We tried, for instance, to subpoena FBI agent William DuBreeze, who we believed could enlighten us on a number of issues. An informant had told us that DuBreeze was so involved with Guy Bannister, David Ferry, and the anti-Castro Cubans that instead of operating out of our local bureau headquarters, he had a special office at the Customs House on Canal Street, close to the scene of anti-Castro activity. DuBreeze was summoned by the parish grand jury, but on the instructions of the Justice Department, he pleaded executive privilege and refused to testify. Later, I felt it was time for the grand jury to hear from Alan Dulles. I wanted to know many things from him, specifically whether or not Clay Shaw, Lee Oswald, David Ferry, Gordon Novel, and Guy Bannister had been associated with the CIA, and why his former deputy, General Cable, had not been questioned by the Warren Commission. I sent off a subpoena to our nation's capital. A brisk letter from the United States Attorney in Washington, D.C. came back shortly. It informed me that he had declined, quote-unquote, to serve the subpoena on Mr. Dulles. Meanwhile, relatives of Richard K. Sunagle, a federal intelligence agent, had been in touch with me. They said that in mid-1963, he had discovered an operation to assassinate President Kennedy. His attempt to warn the government of this, they explained, had resulted in his being sent to the federal penitentiary for 3 years. He was in the process of being released and wanted to meet with me in another city. If I could not go see him, the family would come visit me. I agreed, and two members of his family flew from New York down to New Orleans to set up the meeting. Their confirmation of the story, although lacking in the background which only he could provide, was convincing. However, he refused to travel outside of NYC, where he recently had arrived, following his release from federal prison. I agreed with his family to discuss the matter further the next day. At home that night, I went through the Warren Commission material. According to the hearings index, the name of Nagel had never come up. It did not seem to be in the commission exhibits either. Nevertheless, I was curious about this unusual story and determined to find whatever I could about Nagel. If he had been close enough to the assassination planning to have learned about it in advance, I reasoned, then the federal bureaucracy would have produced a report on Nagel. Even if it had been altered to a point to point in the wrong direction, somewhere there had to be a report. Then, in the commission documents, I finally stumbled across it. The FBI report said in full, "For the record, he would like to say that his association with Oswald," meaning Lee Harvey Oswald, "was purely social and that he had met him in Mexico City and in Texas." Nagel indeed had been on the fringe of things, at least, or he would have not have been in the Bureau's report. It was evident, however, that it had been heavily sanitized. It was one of the shortest reports produced in the entire FBI investigation. There was no reference to Nagel's occupation. There was no hint of why the FBI had questioned him. There was no reference to the federal charge against him at the time the report had been written. Yet the charge had been real enough that he, only now, 3 years later, was getting out of prison. The next morning I met with Nagel's family again at my office, and in a few minutes I was talking to him on the phone. He was explicit in his requirements for a rendezvous. It had to be in NYC. I had to be the one to go there. He would not talk to anyone simply representing me. The meeting had to be in the open air, not in a hotel or other enclosed building. A very uptight guy, I thought, but I assumed he had his reasons. I described a spot in South Central Park, just across from 59th Street from the Plaza Hotel, near the Great Pond. It was an area of light trees and scattered shrubbery and benches. He was agreeable to our meeting there, so I flew to New York. There's an author's note here, let me read it. The airfare, as well as the hotel, now had to be paid by me personally, and this was the way things would be from now on because of the newspaper's watch over our fines and fees fund. Back to the text. A few minutes before the appointed time, I stepped out of the Plaza Hotel and walked across the crowded street into the park. The area was deserted except for a tall, lean man who was standing there with his hands in his pockets. His blondish hair was thinning. He studied me as I approached him. We shook hands and sat down on a bench. It was hard to believe that we were in the heart of New York. There was no one nearby. It was a sunny day, with a light breeze riffling through small trees. There followed, as I recall it, one of the most provocative and frustrating conversations I have ever had. I cannot say he did not warn me at the outset. I'm not going to identify the organization I worked for in 1963, he said. You will simply have to draw your own conclusions about that. Nor will I say exactly what I was working on. I am bound by some laws in this area, and I've already had enough problems from the government without having any new ones. Nevertheless, I could not withhold the query. Were you with the company? I asked him. He shook his head. I cannot answer that question. Then just what information can you give me? I asked him. I had come all the way to New York to hear him recite the standard secrecy agreement that all agents in the intel community are required to sign. I am already on record about my learning that the assassination was scheduled and about my effort to contact the Bureau and warn them about it. As far as I am concerned, I have a right to go into that because I have already done so before. I just thought that you should know firsthand what I have to say. Is this of any interest to you? I nodded. In mid-1963, he had been working for the U.S. government, so Nagel's story began in an agency which he would not identify. The people for whom he worked, a vagueness from which he never departed, were curious about a project involving a fellow named Lee Oswald and some other men. Consequently, Nagel was assigned to spend some time establishing the necessary relationships and observing. In late August or early September of 1963, for reasons he would not spell out, it became apparent that an exceedingly large, he emphasized the word large, operation pointing toward the assassination of President Kennedy was underway. At just about the time of this discovery, for reasons he wouldn't explain, the individual who had given him his assignment was moved to another part of the country, and Nagel suddenly found himself without a direct contact. It was a strange tale, Nagel being frozen out by the very government agency which had assigned him to conduct a penetration of the ongoing activity. I can only say that Nagel impressed me as being utterly honest and sincere in his account. Knowing what was going to happen, he went on, but having no way of knowing when, he decided that the best solution was to notify J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI. He wrote Hoover a letter spelling out all that he had been able to learn about the proposed assassination. He sent the letter registered, return receipt requested. Then, as the days and weeks passed with no answer from the FBI chief, he concluded that his attempt to warn of what was approaching had been in vain. Worse, he sensed from the silence which his letter had meant that there was a very real danger of his being drawn into a trap. After all, he had been in the company of Oswald and others with him during much of the summer of 1963. Finally, in what he admitted was an act of desperation, he decided that his one safe course was to ensure that he was in a federal institution on the day the assassination occurred. He would rather be charged, he reasoned, with malicious mischief than to be drawn into a giant trap involving the assassination of a president. Smart. He walked into a federal bank in El Paso, fired several shots in the ceiling, and then waited outside, sitting on the curb, until the guard came running by. He had to call back the guard, who, in his haste, had rushed past him. But Nagel was not charged with malicious mischief. The government had charged him with armed robbery. Moreover, at his trial, he was convicted, and the judge sentenced him to 10 years imprisonment. There's an author's note here. He had ended up serving 3 years. 2 years later, his conviction was reversed on the grounds there was no evidence of intent to rob. Back to the text. Nagel answered a few questions. Had he actually been in physical association with Lee Oswald? I mean, right there with him? Yes, he replied to me. And with other men connected with Oswald? The answer was yes. Where did this occur? In New Orleans and in Texas. I asked him whether these other men and Oswald all were working together on the project of whether the others were manipulating Oswald. He thought this question through at some length. Then he said he did not pretend to have been close enough to know for sure, but his intuition was that the others had manipulated Oswald from the outset. That's big. I think that is the case. Continuing on, I asked him the names of the other men. He hesitated, but when the answer came, it was specific. Guy Bannister, Clay Shaw, and David Ferry. With what organization were these men connected? Now he looked at me with a half smile and shook his head slowly. I pressed him. Were they connected with the CIA? I cannot discuss or name any government organization, he replied. In spite of the troubles he had been through, he would not say a word about the intel community at large, with the single exception of the FBI's having ignored his warning letter about President Kennedy's murder. And that was the sum of Nagel's story. Beyond the precise parameters he had established, he would not be budged a centimeter. During most of my flight home, I reflected long and hard on my Central Park meeting with Richard Case Nagel. I had studied him closely for all of the 3 hours or so we were together, and I was satisfied that weaving a fabricated tale was not in this man's makeup. On the other hand, there seemed to be no getting around the fact that his account was not easy to digest. I concluded that I probably would have to chalk up the Central Park scene to experience. Many years down the road, I found myself reading an account of Nagel's arrest by East German police as he attempted to cross back into West Germany. Richard Case Nagel definitely was not your basic insurance salesman. Whether Nagel had come to me on his own or had been sent by some intelligence apparatus to set me up in some unknown way, I never learned. But another incident that followed me made me realize that I could be entrapped and discredited at any time. Increasingly, I had begun making speeches at various universities, hoping that by communicating with students throughout the country, I could offset the hysterical assault of the plainly unified mass media. Equally important, I had fast been using up my savings from the National Guard and the fees from these talks, which were becoming helpful in continuing to finance our investigation. So here I was about to go on the road again. This time I had a speech coming up at New Mexico University, and it was on this trip that our domestic intelligence structure made its first attempt to entrap me. I arrived at the university in Albuquerque in the afternoon, and that evening spoke for several hours to the students. I received a heartwarming and encouraging response, as I usually did at universities. Almost immediately after the talk, Bill Boxley, the former CIA man who had become one of my volunteer investigators, appeared in the lobby of my motel. I was surprised to see him because I thought he was back in New Orleans. Pulling me off to the side, he told me, with great concern, that word had been received that an attempt was going to be made to kill me. He had been left with no alternative but to fly to Mexico, where he could act as my bodyguard. He expressed relief at having made it there in time. I had always had a high regard for Boxley's intelligence and ability. For once, however, I was furious. I found an empty table and led him to it. "I notice," I said, "that you always carry a .45. He nodded, patting his shoulder holster. "What branch of the army were you in before you went into the CIA?" I asked. He paused, uncertain where I was headed. "The infantry. I was a dog face for years. Then the Army Counterintelligence Corps. Then into the agency. What's the problem?" "When you were in the Army," I asked him, "did you have a chance to find out what an order meant?" He nodded. "Do you happen to remember," I continued, "my ordering everyone on my staff not to participate in passing on these horror stories, these endless rumors about how somebody's going to be killed?" "Yes, but," he began. "There is no but," I told him. "I don't appreciate your dumping this paranoid garbage on me, and I don't appreciate your inability to follow a simple order. Especially," I added, "when it means that I'm personally going to end up paying for your flight out here and back."
The last I growled at him almost savagely because Boxley was always out of money and I continually had to write checks for him. Over my angry objections, still adamantly protesting that I needed protection, Boxley shared my suite at the motel that night. Placing his large .45 pistol on the table beside him, he slept on the sofa. The next morning, he went with me to the airport and saw me off to L.A., where I had some people to meet in connection with our investigation. When I arrived at the L.A. airport, I went straight to the magazine rack to buy something to read. There were no seats at the L.A. airport baggage claim area, and I've always been allergic to standing around wasting time. Consequently, as I had remarked to Boxley a month or so earlier, when the flight to L.A. had been mentioned, at the L.A. airport, I always went to the men's room, sat down in the toilet, and read a magazine for about 10 minutes until my luggage arrived. Then I would pick it up, hail a cab, and be on my way. This time, something unusual happened. After buying a copy of Life, I went into the men's room to read it. I opened to an article by General James Gavin recommending that we adopt new techniques of defense in the Vietnam War. At just that moment, I heard the door in the booth right next to me open and close. I had taken the first in a long line of empty booths. When someone almost immediately entered the very next booth, I knew something was wrong. I closed the magazine on my lap and I listened. Then I heard low, whispering voices at the door. I did not wait a second longer. Since all I had intended to do was read, I was already fully dressed and thus was able to open the door of the booth quickly. Two fat, uniformed airport policemen were struck momentarily in the exit door of the men's room as they sought to rush out of it simultaneously, apparently in response to my unexpected emergence. The three of us left together. Then I saw a ring of at least a half a dozen additional airport police in uniforms, gathered in a semicircle around the entrance to the men's room. Even as it was dawning on me that I had been set up, the sergeant in charge of them addressed me sharply. "Hey, mister," he said in an accusatory tone, "how long were you in that men's room?" The answer, of course, was 2 or 3 minutes at the outside. However, under the circumstances, that hardly was the point. Even as he addressed me, I noticed that two women assistants working at the counter for one of the rent-a-car services were staring at me and had recognized me. As a byproduct of the intensive media assault, I had been receiving almost continual TV coverage. This was one occasion when it was useful. "That's none of your goddamn business," I yelled at him. I turned, and as I walked past the other policeman toward the luggage ramp, I saw the sergeant in charge shake his head. The other policeman, who had been standing in my way, moved apart and let me through. Climbing into a cab, I knew how lucky I had been to get away. As I had a chance to reflect, I realized that there was more to the snare than had been visible. I remembered a curious phone call I had received about 3 weeks earlier from Los Angeles. The call had come to my house in New Orleans, where I had an unlisted telephone number. The caller was a man I had not seen in many years. I had once represented him briefly on a federal case. I recalled him as a grimy, furtive, and disheveled homosexual who sold pornographic photographs for a living. Such a client was hardly to my choosing, but at the time I was in the business of representing criminal as well as civil cases, and so I had accepted this case. But this man failed to pay me, and I notified the court that I was no longer his attorney. Years later, only 3 weeks before the bizarre incident at the airport, this character had called me out of the blue. After he identified himself, I asked him how he had obtained my unlisted number. He responded vaguely that he had connections. I then asked him why he was calling me, and he launched into a weird explanation. He was thinking of visiting New Orleans during the next Mardi Gras, he said, and he thought perhaps we could get together. I told him that I had no intention of getting together with him anytime or anywhere and slammed down the phone. Now, I suddenly realized who had been placed in the booth next to me just prior to my intended arrest at the Los Angeles airport. As an experienced prosecutor, it was not difficult for me to envision what would have happened had I not shot out of the men's room so quickly, emerging along with the two policemen. one way or the other, my seedy former client would have arranged to come out of his stall at about the same time as I emerged from mine. Any of a variety of eminently prosecutable scenes would have been created. The airport police would have responded, and at my subsequent trial for violating some obscenity misdemeanor under California law, I would have found myself as the defendant under cross-examination. At the appropriate moment, a prosecutor would have asked me if I still had any relationship with my former client, who would have just finished testifying for the prosecution. I would have responded, of course, that I did not. Then the prosecutor would have produced the man's Los Angeles telephone bill. It would have on it a long-distance call to me at my unlisted home number in New Orleans. That would have been the end of the ballgame. My conviction of the sex demeanor charge would have made headlines across the nation. The Louisiana legislature would have been left with no alternative but to remove me from office, and the CIA would have accomplished one more dirty trick in the name of national security. Do you see what was happening here, folks? I analyzed the whole affair repeatedly during my visit in L.A. and my flight home. But I could not figure out how the L.A. airport police knew exactly what flight I would be on. The answer came much later, when Vincent Salandria, a distinguished Philadelphia attorney who was the most prominent critic of the Warren Commission's explanation of President Kennedy's bullet wounds, came down to see our investigative team in action. On the day Salandria arrived, Bill Boxley was presenting to the special team some evidence he had tracked down in Dallas on a recent trip. After the meeting broke up, Salandria asked me if he could look at other material, memos, notes, from Boxley. I picked out some samples from the files, and Salandria spent the rest of the day going through the folders. When we got home, he suggested we go into the living room and talk. "You once mentioned your concern about your office being penetrated," he said almost idly as he turned over the papers on his lap. Salandria had an unusually soft, unruffled voice, suggestive of silk sliding across silk. "That's right," I said. "Perhaps you get paranoid in this sort of thing. It's just a feeling I've had." "Jim," he said softly, "I'm afraid your friend, Beau Boxley, works for the federal government." I had a cold feeling over my entire body. And then Salandria methodically showed me why that had to be the case. Boxley's memos and summaries, each impressive in its own right, did not add up when evaluated as a whole. It was embarrassingly apparent that Boxley's material had been designed, first, to intrigue me, and second, to lead nowhere at all. Salandria picked up the phone and called Boxley. "Bill," he said, "Jim and I have been having a conversation. We're over at his place. We wondered if he could come by." 2 hours later, I looked at my watch. "He's not coming over," I said. "I think you'll find that Mr. Boxley has gone," he replied. I got Lou Ivan on the phone and told him to come over. Then we drove to Boxley's rented room on Canal Boulevard. I had never been in it. The landlady let us in the front door. "No," she said, "I haven't seen the man since he rented the room earlier this year. He just sends me a check every month." She showed me Boxley's room. A shirt, folded from the cleaners, had been tossed on the bed. "He left that shirt here 6 months ago," she said. I showed her Boxley's home number in my address book. She shook her head. "There's no phone with that number here." "Somewhere around here," Salandria purred, "the government has to have a very comfortable safe house, but I doubt if we'll ever see it." I didn't reply. I was thinking about the incident at the LA airport. It finally hit me. It was Boxley who had told the airport police which flight I would be on. He had called them from New Mexico after seeing me get on the plane. The story about an attempt to kill me was concocted. His real mission had been not to protect me, but to set me up. I was disgusted with myself. I had been so blind. In contrast, Vincent Salandria had taken a single day away from his law practice in Philadelphia, flown down, and had pegged Boxley virtually in one sharp-eyed glance. The next day, we learned that Boxley had traveled to Beaumont, Texas, following Salandria's phone call. From there, using the name of Wood, he sent telegrams to the editors of the Times-Picayune newspaper and each of the local television stations stating that he had resigned as an office investigator upon learning that I was addicted to drugs. A reporter from one of the TV stations gave a copy of the telegram to Lou Ivan and asked him curiously who this man Wood was, but that's as far as the story got. Boxley's 11th hour... Boxley's 11th hour activity disappeared like a stone dropped in the center of Lake Pontchartrain, leaving not a ripple. Still, the man had been sitting in on our innermost meetings for months. With his big briefcase always in his hand, he had been in and out of our file room 100 times. I had to admit that I had been badly fooled. And worse, every one of our files now had to be considered duplicated by the federal government. Okay, that's the end of chapter 14. Let's go ahead and move on to 15, shall we? Boy, this is really interesting stuff. And this is great not only to hear about as a story and as a thriller, but to hear the tactics, the methods, so that we can use it in our own activities and always be on the lookout, right? It's always good to learn the enemy's tricks and learn the plays in their playbook. At least I think so. Okay, let's move on to chapter 15. This is entitled Shell Game. Nearly 2 years elapsed between Clay Shaw's arrest on March 1st, 1967, and the beginning of his trial. Our office spent much of that time prosecuting routine local crimes, countering legal maneuvers by Shaw's lawyers, and preparing our case against Shaw. The leads we pursued took us in many directions, some of which had little to do with Shaw. For me, the most fascinating research in this latter part of the investigation involved the cover-up of the truth about the assassination by law enforcement officials and the media. The manipulations of evidence by the Warren Commission and the Dallas Homicide Unit in their investigations of the murder of J.D. Tippit were prime examples. Tippit, of course, was the Dallas police officer who was shot to death approximately half an hour after the assassination. The murder took place across the dry Trinity River from Dallas in the suburb of Oak Park, not too far from where Lee Oswald was boarding at the time. Though the case was never tried, both the Warren Commission and the Dallas Homicide agreed that the killer, who left the scene with an icy nonchalance, flicking away used shells from his gun, was Lee Oswald. This was a useful conclusion. Among other things, it provided the government with a motivation for the assassination. Lee Oswald was a troubled and temperamental young man, so violent that he was capable of shooting down a police officer in cold blood with no provocation. Therefore, such a savage madman was also capable of murdering the president for no reason. Or, as one member of the Warren Commission's legal staff rhetorically posed the question in the answer, how do we know that Lee Oswald killed President Kennedy? Because he killed Officer Tippit. Conveniently, the converse also worked. Only a man who had just killed the president and knew he was being hunted down would have any reason to shoot a police officer in a quiet suburb at midday. The only problem with this scenario was that, as so often before, when I examined the evidence, the damning conclusions about Oswald just did not hold up. First of all, given what was known about Oswald's movements, it was highly improbable that he could have been physically present at the time of Tippett's murder. According to several eyewitnesses at the scene, Tippit was shot anywhere from 1:06 to 1:10 p.m. Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig, who was at the book depository at the time, confirmed this. When he heard the report of Tippett's death on the radio, he looked at his watch. It was 1:06. And yet Oswald, it was generally acknowledged, had returned to his rooming house at around 1 p.m. He left quickly, and Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper, observed him standing by the northbound Beckley Avenue bus stop at 1:04. The area where Tippett was killed was in the opposite direction, a mile to the south. Using the broadest interpretation of the time element, even if Oswald had changed his mind about the bus and run southward, it was virtually impossible for him to have arrived at the scene before the shooting of the police officer. The Warren Commission simply ignored these time anomalies and presented various eyewitnesses whose testimony quickly fell apart. Domingo Benavides, who had been the closest of all the witnesses to the shooting, a few yards away, would not identify Oswald as having been there. Warren Reynolds, who had seen a gunman running on Jefferson Street a block from the shooting, did testify that the man he had seen was Oswald, but the circumstances of his testimony were highly suspicious. Reynolds initially had told the FBI that he would hesitate to identify Oswald as the running man. Shortly afterwards, Reynolds has been shot in the head in the dark of a car lot basement. After a miraculous recovery in the hospital, Reynolds had second thoughts about what he had seen and decided the running man was actually Oswald. Wow. The inconsequential testimony of these and several other witnesses left Helen Markham as the centerpiece of the government's case against Oswald. As I read Markham's testimony, it occurred to me that few prosecutors had ever found themselves with a witness at once so eager to serve their cause and simultaneously so destructive to it. While the other witnesses at the scene unanimously agreed that Tippett died instantly, Markham explicitly recalled trying to talk with him for 20 minutes before the ambulance arrived. Despite the Warren Commission's lawyer's excruciating attempt to lead her to an identification of Lee Oswald, a fairly tall and skinny young man with thinning light brown hair, she informed Mark Lane, a well-known critic of the government's investigation, that Tippett's killer was stocky and had bushy hair. Thereafter, under oath, she denied having done so, and only admitted it after hearing a tape recording of the conversation. Then, making matters even more confusing for the government, Markham described the killer she saw as having black hair. Before her testimony was completed, Markham had raised doubts in the minds of some observers that she even was at the scene of Tippett's murder. At least two witnesses did not recall seeing her there. Yet, with all that, Markham was the government's best witness, the only one who identified Lee Oswald as the killer of Officer Tippett. And here is how that identification went before the Warren Commission. Mr. Ball. Now, when you went into the room, you looked these people over, these four men, is that correct? Mrs. Markham replies, yes, sir. Mr. Ball, did you recognize anyone in the lineup? Mrs. Markham, no, sir. Ball asks, you didn't? Did you see anybody? I have asked you that question before. Did you recognize anybody from their face? From their face, no, Mrs. Markham replied. Did you identify anybody in these four people? Mrs. Markham replies, I didn't know nobody. Mr. Ball, I know you didn't know anybody, but did anybody in that lineup look like anybody you had seen before? Mrs. Markham responds, no, I had never seen none of them before. Mr. Ball asks, no one of the four? Mrs. Markham responds, no one of them. Mr. Ball asks again, no one of all four? Mrs. Markham replies, no, sir. Ultimately, out of desperation, the commission's attorney had to resort to putting a leading question to his own witness, absolutely inadmissible in any real court, in order to telegraph to the witness what he wanted to hear. Mr. Ball asks, you recognized him from his appearance? Mrs. Markham responds, I asked. I looked at him. When I saw this man, I wasn't sure, but I had cold chills just run over me. This brief exchange constituted the totality of the witness testimony identifying Lee Oswald as Tippett's murder. There were other significant witnesses, of course. Among these were the ambulance driver and his helper, who could have clarified at the time of Tippett's death and which witnesses were present at the scene. Mr. and Mrs. Donald Higgins, who lived directly across from the murder scene and observed some of what occurred. T.F. Bally, who used the dead officer's car microphone to inform the police radio dispatcher that Tippett had just been killed. But none of these was ever called by the Warren Commission. There were also three important witnesses to the murder who changed the whole face of the case for me. I discovered them in the rapidly burgeoning body of work by legitimate critics of the commission. Mark Lane, the critic who later came to New Orleans to work with our investigation, had tracked down and interviewed one of these witnesses, named Akilah Clemens. Before the first shot, she observed two men standing near Officer Tippett's police car. She saw one of the men with a pistol, waving away the other as he trotted toward Jefferson Street on a far side of the block. The running man, the one she recalled as having shot the police officer, was, in her words, kinda short, kinda heavy. The second man, she recalled, is tall and thin, wearing a white shirt and khaki slacks. Clothing which no other witnesses recalled Oswald wearing that day. Akilah Clemens said Dallas police officers told her not to tell anyone what she had seen lest she be killed. A familiar piece of law enforcement advice in Dallas that day. I also learned about Frank Wright from Mark Lane. There's an author's note here. Let me read it. Mark Lane's locating and interviewing of key witnesses to Officer Tippett's shooting probably was the earliest and most outstanding work done by all the critics of the official conclusion concerning the assassination. Back to the text. Wright saw the last part of the scene that Clemens had described. It was Wright's wife who called the ambulance that carried Tippett's dead body away. Mr. Wright, who had been inside the house, came out in time to see Officer Tippett roll over on the ground, probably the last move of his life. Wright observed another man looking down on the fallen officer. Then the man circled around the police car and got into an old gray car on the other side of it. He drove off rapidly. It seemed to me quite probable that this was the second man Clemens had observed, the one who was waved off by the short, heavy one who ran away. It began to dawn on me that these witnesses were saying something no one else had said. Officer Tippett was killed by two men, neither of whom was Lee Oswald. The implications, I realized, were staggering. If Oswald was innocent of the Tippett murder, the foundation of the government's case against him collapsed. 3 years before, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover must have come to the same conclusion I did, because he explicitly ordered the special agent in charge of the Dallas Bureau office not to permit his agents to question Akilah Clemens or Mr. and Mrs. Wright. I did not know this until many years later, when the FBI memo from Hoover to Gordon Shanklin was revealed in a book by Michael Kurtz. But one thing I did know at the time was that I could not find a shred of testimony from Clemens or the Wrights in the Warren Commission materials. As I continued my research, I discovered that, beyond the eyewitnesses, there was other evidence gathered and altered by the Dallas Homicide Unit showing that Lee Oswald had been framed in the Tippett murder. For instance, I read transcripts of the messages sent over the Dallas police radio shortly after the murder. These were recorded automatically on a log. Just minutes after a citizen first reported the murder on Tippett's radio, Patrolman H.W. Summers in Dallas Police Unit Number 221, which is the designation for the squad car, reported that an eyeball witness to the getaway man had been located. The suspect was described as having black wavy hair, wearing an Eisenhower jacket of light color, with dark trousers and a white shirt. He was apparently armed with a .32 dark finish automatic pistol, which he had in his right hand. Moments later, Sergeant G. Hill reported that the shell at the scene indicates that the suspect is armed with an automatic .38 rather than a pistol. There's an author's note here. Let me read it. To appreciate the injustice described here, it is necessary to understand the difference between an automatic handgun and a revolver. An automatic contains the bullets in a clip, which fits inside its handle. Each time the gun is fired, the empty cartridge remaining in the chamber is automatically flipped out by the ejector mechanism as the new cartridge and bullet are pushed up into place by a spring at the bottom of the clip. A revolver, typified in American tradition by the long-barreled hand weapon of the Old West, holds its cartridges and bullets in a circular revolving chamber and does not automatically eject each cartridge as fired. One of the major differences between the two weapons is that each time the automatic flips out a used cartridge, it leaves on it an ineradicable mark of the ejector mechanism. A revolver does not do this. It leaves only the mark of the firing pin. Another difference is that revolvers are usually all metal and have a relatively small gripping handle, whereas an automatic has a large, flat handle, which ordinarily has a dark blue metallic finish. Okay, back to the text. It seemed clear to me from this that the handgun used to shoot Tippit was an automatic, but the gun allegedly taken from Lee Oswald when Dallas police later arrested him at the Texas Theater was a revolver. Unless Oswald had stopped and changed guns, which no one had ever suggested, this fact alone put a severe hole in the government's case. The bullets found in Officer Tippett's body and the cartridges found at the scene of his murder yielded further evidence of the frame-up. The Dallas coroner had conducted an autopsy on Tippett's body and removed 4 bullets from it. 3 of them, it turned out, were copper-coated and had been manufactured by the Winchester Western Company. The 4th, however, was a lead bullet made by the Remington Peters Company. This was awfully strange, I thought, because bullets were never sold in mixed lots. Gun users bought either a box of all Winchesters or one of all Remingtons, but not some of each. The discovery of 2 different makes of bullets in Tippett's body indicated to me, and would indicate to most experienced police officers, a likelihood that 2 different gunmen, did the shooting. This was consistent with the eyewitness testimony of Akilah Clemens and Mr. and Mrs. Wright. When a homicide occurs, it is standard operating procedure for the police homicide division to send off the bullets and cartridges to the FBI lab in Washington, D.C. for study and possible identification of the gun that fired them. In this case, the Dallas Homicide Unit, understandably shy about advertising the coroner's discovery, sent only 1 bullet to the FBI lab, informing the Bureau that this was the only bullet found in Tippett's body. To everyone's surprise, the Bureau lab found that the bullet did not match Oswald's revolver. When it discovered this oddity, the Warren Commission was inspired to look for other bullets that might match up better. Although the commission never received a copy of Tippett's autopsy report, somehow it found out that 4 bullets, rather than merely 1, had been found in Tippett's body. The ordinarily incurious commission asked the FBI to inquire about the 3 missing bullets, and they were found, after 4 months, gathering dust in the files of the Dallas Homicide Division. These bullets were sent to the FBI lab, but Special Agent Cortland Cunningham, the ballistics expert from the lab, testified before the commission that the lab was unable to conclude that any of the 4 bullets found in Tippett's body had been fired by the revolver taken from Lee Oswald. The cartridges allegedly found at the scene proved even more problematic. While the bullets had initially been under the control of the coroner who found them in Tippett's body, the cartridges, the metal casings which provide propulsion power to the bullets, were Dallas Homicide's responsibility from the outset. On the very day of Officer Tippett's murder, Dallas Homicide had made a summary of all the evidence it had in the case, a most important standard police procedure. Although a number of witnesses mentioned that they had seen cartridges strewn around after the shooting, and the early recorded radio messages had described the murder weapon as an automatic because of the ejector marks on the cartridges found at the scene, this summary did not include cartridges of any kind. It was not until 6 days after it had sent the single bullet to the FBI lab in Washington that the Dallas Homicide Division finally added 4 cartridges allegedly found at the scene to the Tippett evidence summary. The cartridges were then sent off to Washington, and the Bureau Lab promptly reported back that they had indeed been fired by the same revolver that Oswald allegedly purchased through the mail under the alias of A. Heidel. The Dallas police force may have been relieved to hear this result, but to me, the late appearance of the cartridges only focused more attention on the Dallas Homicide Unit's unconscionable manipulation of evidence. I knew that if the cartridges had actually been fired by Oswald before his arrest, they routinely would have been included in the summary of evidence and sent off to the FBI lab on the evening of the murder. But these cartridges were not sent until well after Dallas Homicide had learned that the lab could not find positive markings from Oswald's gun on the single bullet. In parentheses here, this evaluation would have come from the Washington lab to the Dallas Bureau office by telex within 24 hours. It seemed clear to me what had happened. Having failed to get a positive ID with Oswald's revolver from the bullet, Dallas Homicide was not about to send off cartridges with an automatic handgun's ejector marks on them, even if these were the actual cartridges found at the scene. Instead, someone in the homicide division or cooperating with it had fired the confiscated revolver after Oswald's arrest, thereby obtaining the needed cartridges bearing its imprint. Then, those cartridges were sent to Washington. However, competence was not the Dallas Homicide Unit's strong suit, even in fabricating evidence. The FBI lab found that two of the cartridge cases had been manufactured by Western and two by Remington. Since the lab had already concluded that three of the bullets found in Tippett's body were copper-coated Westerns and one was a lead Remington, these numbers simply did not add up. Worse yet, at the Warren Commission hearings, it became embarrassingly apparent that the used cartridges that the Dallas Homicide team had sent to the FBI lab were not the cartridges actually found at the scene of Tippett's murder. One witness, Domingo Benavides, found two used cartridge shells not far from the shooting and handed them to Officer J.M. Poe. Dallas Police Sergeant Gerald Hill instructed Poe to mark them, i.e., to scratch his initials on them in order to maintain the chain of evidence. This is standard operating procedure for all homicide officers everywhere. Poe informed the Warren Commission that he believed he had marked them, but he could not swear to it. At the commission hearing, Poe examined four cartridges that were shown to him but was unable to identify his marks on them. Sergeant W.E. Barnes informed the commission that he had received two cartridges from Officer Poe back at police headquarters and had added his own initials to them. However, he too was unable to positively ID the two shells. After I had gone through all the evidence, I knew I had some serious thinking to do. My study suggested that two men had murdered Officer J.D. Tippett. This did not surprise me. For the architects of the assassination of the president to have sent one layman armed with a .38 caliber handgun to eliminate a trained police officer would have been a bad mistake. Any experienced officer wounded once or even twice by a .38, the heaviest caliber used in the Tippett murder, could still, with some luck, end up shooting his assailant through the head. So, if the removal of Tippett was important to the plot, perhaps as a way to set up Oswald and show that he was indeed brutally violent, then at least two men were needed to do the job properly. The overwhelming evidence that Oswald had not committed the Tippett murder confirmed all the prior research I had done, indicating that Oswald was a mild-mannered man incapable of such violence. In the Shaw trial to come, I knew that if I could convince a jury that Oswald was incapable of murdering John Kennedy or J.D. Tippett, this would improve our chances for a conviction immensely. It would immediately force the jury to consider the possibility of a conspiracy as a realistic alternative to the Warren Commission scenario. But the Tippett case was most significant to me because it revealed the extent of a cover-up perpetrated by the Dallas Police Department, or rather, by the Dallas Police Homicide Unit. I had to remind myself that in a city of Dallas's size, the homicide unit was small, ranging from 6 to 9 police officers. A sophisticated planner of the assassination would have been able to predict who would be investigating after the crime was committed and might well be able to control the key people. But just because this unit, under the iron command of Captain Will Fritz for more than 3 decades, had concealed and manipulated evidence, was no reason to condemn the entire department. I recalled what I knew about the homicide unit's behavior in the Kennedy case. It had discovered a possible murder weapon, a 7.65 Mauser rifle, in the 6th floor lair of the Texas School Book Depository, and promptly lost it. It had questioned Lee Oswald for 12 hours and failed to record a word of the interrogation. It had allowed several suspects in the vicinity of Dealey Plaza to be released without as much as getting their names or mugshots. It had failed to check out the Nash Rambler station wagon that Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig had spotted taking Oswald away from the book depository. Indeed, it had lied about the incident, denying that Craig had ever been at police headquarters. Worst of all, it had allowed Oswald to be killed in the basement of its own headquarters, surrounded by dozens of police officers, and then immediately closed its books on the assassination, considering it solved. Now added to this appalling record was the blatant manipulation of evidence in the Tippit case, the concealing of 3 bullets, the disappearance of automatic cartridges found at the scene, the tardy discovery, quote-unquote, of revolver cartridges, the failure to pursue any leads to the 2 men who had been seen by eyewitnesses. At first, it seemed to me that Dallas Homicide's objective had been to develop a case against Oswald, the man it had hastily decided was the assassin. No matter what it took, it wanted to pin the Tippit murder on Oswald, thus bolstering the proposition that he was indeed capable of killing the president for no apparent reason. But as I reviewed the record, a second, more horrifying thought occurred to me. Perhaps Dallas Homicide had systematically altered evidence, not just to nail Oswald in a fit of misguided patriotism. Perhaps it had behaved as it had intentionally, to protect the actual killers of both John Kennedy and J.D. Tippit. If that were true, it would mean we were dealing with something beyond incompetence, even beyond cover-up. It would mean that Dallas Homicide, or key members of it, had at worst colluded in the assassination before it happened, or at best actively ratified it afterwards. That is the end of chapter 15. I hope you guys have enjoyed. We'll see you on the flip side of the next segment, starting with chapter 16. And we are steadily moving toward the final chapters of the book by my judging where we're at in the book. We've got maybe 100 pages to go. So about 2/3 of the way through. I hope you guys have enjoyed. This is Ted Midward of tedmidward.info. Until next time, take care. God bless. Bye-bye.